solution.
Yeah, it's a viable solution. If we had people who could run the numbers, we would have a handle. We'd have our hands on the handle here. But at the same time, what can we do as, you know, philosophers, as people that can question and debate kind of the ethics of it? Well, I think that is one of the things that we can do, is we can gain a kind of certitude about what we are doing. We can, I don't think we can dispel the ambiguities, but we can learn to be more comfortable in the ambiguities, that yes, there's obvious advantages and disadvantages to certain things that we're doing, but we can put it on the table and we can make a decision. And there's, you know, you make a decision because there's alternatives. If there was one option, you would just do that one option. When you decide on one thing, the people who argued for that other thing aren't going to get what they want. But you've hashed it out. You've come to that decision. And ultimately, when you're making decisions at that level, that's a political decision.
Yeah, and I would say that's kind of what's happened, right?
With
the overload of our healthcare system, with the homeless population, mm-hmm. and everything going on. And I would say the biggest thing would be the fentanyl crisis, right? So when it comes to that, like, I don't think that...
Just before you get into that, I want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We're about halfway through our episode. We've been talking about two-tiered healthcare systems in Canada, the challenges, the ambiguities, and is it ethically justified? I think at this point we're all on the same page that it's not justified. But then how is it not justified, and how do we deal with it, and what are the complexities of the issue? Please continue.
I don't want to say it's not actually mm-hmm. as much as a thing. I don't want to say that it's not justified. I'd say it's not ideal. Okay. Like it's definitely not ideal. But I mean, like maybe the situation. So
that's what I fight for, right? Because I think that's the hard part. Because it's like, is it justified because we have allowed our mental health institutions to go away, that we've put all of our people that need on the streets instead of in an institution? We've made that policy decision, so then therefore are we justified in having two-tiered medicine? I still don't think so, because I don't think that the benefit outweighs the risk. I would rather just focus on what's going on with the vulnerable population instead of worrying about where I can allocate somebody's extra funding that they have available for their child. Like, I think that it's just like when you look at the crisis in Canada, that's not going to make a difference.
Yeah. And you were going to talk about fentanyl before I cut you off. Hmm? You were going to talk about fentanyl before I
cut
you off?
Yeah, fentanyl itself, mm-hmm. and just like how that really strikes one of the biggest problems in Canada right now is how we're dealing with the fentanyl crisis. We did have a policy kind of in place where it was supposed to be this three-tiered medicine, like three pillars, with like safe injection and having medicine available for people to try and get off heavy drugs. That doesn't really seem to be playing out the way that they wanted it to. So therefore, like, it just seems like, okay, so that's a failure on our system. So then how do we ethically move forward?
Would you say that there's a distinction between, because you're asking how do we ethically move forward? I think that, because obviously when you are making these decisions, you have to consider the morality of things. You're, especially within this like particular topic, because you're treating people for things like this, sometimes involuntarily. But I'm curious as well about the fact that we did try something. We made a decision. Good, we made a decision to try and address this. But apparently it seems to be failing. What would you... I guess I'm wondering if there is like an ethical dimension to having to make a decision in light of the fact that one of the decisions that we tried to make didn't seem to be working. We had to change courses.
Yeah.
There's a dimension
I think until the working population is affected, nothing will change.
The fentanyl crisis is quite complicated. And you know, the three-pillar system is problematic. That system was set up in response to more like traditional drug problems, and particularly problems around, you know, prevalence of Hep C and AIDS and that kind of stuff within these sorts of communities. And those sorts of systems, especially stuff like safe injection sites and harm reduction facilities and stuff like that, were actually highly effective in dealing with those sorts of things. The issue becomes is much more complicated because fentanyl as a recreational substance is quite new. It's not just fentanyl, but it's also a prevalence of various kinds of benzo analogs and tranquilizers and stuff like that, that there's really no adequate system to deal with. And so, like, something like a safe injection site, you know, especially ones like InSight and other ones that are placed in already very high use areas, regardless of whether or not they're going to be there, still serve are still highly functional in their original goal of preventing overdose deaths, taking stress off of the general medical system, and preventing stuff like the spread of AIDS and Hep C, properly dealing with harm reduction materials like needles and pipes and things like that, right? Those things have actually been like highly effective. Okay. The issue is more that the current drug supply has far more knock-on severe effects with users than stuff like traditional heroin or whatever it might have been, right? Which creates a much more complicated situation in terms of their medical and mental health needs. Really, the three-pillar system, probably the most problematic, is not the safe use sites, but is the deinstitutionalization of mental health facilities, right? That's like the most, you know, and that's with like what we see. These are generally involving people who have like very, very severe mental health issues that the system just does not have placement for, or has really emphasized individual independence within the medical system, which ostensibly is great, except you get into a lot of gray areas where you have people who one day can seem pretty like with it and okay, and then a week later they're like violently psychotic, you know, attacking random people, right? And so how do you differentiate that?
Which is horrible, right?
Yeah, which is
terrible.
It all
has to do with the fact that, like, you know, somebody, they couldn't find them to go give them their meds or something.
Yeah, right? Exactly, right? Like, it's, yeah, and having, you know, relying on things like outreach teams and, mm-hmm. you know, like in place.
It was a good idea.
It's a nice idea, and it works for a certain degree of people. There's a more severe subset of the population, though, that it does not work for, and we just no longer have basically the beds and care available to deal with those sorts of individuals. And then the other one too is the Canadian justice system has become increasingly loose on sentencing, and so there is just a lot more individuals getting very, I think the general public would agree, like quite low sentences for repeat, particularly violent crimes and stuff like that, which then presents the issue of those individuals reoffending, which is a very consistent occurrence. Those individuals actually make up a very small portion of that. If you have a 2 or 3 or 4% of that population that are committing individually hundreds of offenses, that is going to appear to be a highly problematic issue within that community.
I would say offenses as well as in like frequent flyers going to the hospital as well, like just to bring it back to healthcare. Like that's
yeah,
and
you
problem.
Also have a lot of people going
filling up the roster.
There is also like the public safety element as well, where people are, through no fault of their own, are being constantly subjected to danger by these violent people or these people who behave violently. It's not fair to ordinary individuals in society to encounter this or justified for them to expect this like into the future. Like this, there should be some, this will have to be dealt with sooner rather than later.
The Canadian judicial system relies very heavily on jurisprudence, and because there's been a trend in particular directions in terms of sentencing, it becomes very difficult to then turn around and basically make a U-turn on that kind of sentencing. Because let's say if there's been a trend towards, you know, like lighter sentences, more, you know, basically like community releases, that kind of thing, right? To then say, oh, actually, like this guy's come in, he's committed similar offenses to these past people, I'm going to throw the book at him, right, and give him like the max number of years, let's say in a prison or whatever, it's very easy to overturn that verdict on appeal because it does not fit with the jurisprudence narrative that's been going on. Yeah, it's argued, lawyers can easily argue it's not fair, right? And that is what actually what happens quite frequently. You see a lot of times these people get out on appeal.
Yeah, like a lot of the times, like violent people will come into the hospital and like they should be charged and they won't because there's no point.
So if that is the case, then like in theory, couldn't we just state a new, like start a new precedent? Start a new precedent. Like if
you
someone
would in theory have
if,
to
if someone, you know, commits 5 violent crimes in 1 year, then they have to be treated differently than other we've treated this in the past, and they need like due to the welfare of the public being impinged, we have to consider longer sentencing or the same amount of sentencing, which we will revisit at a later date.
But some of that you could say though is like it's the system that has created this problem, and it's not even their own fault at this point. So how do you give them this like that they are the ones that should pay for it when it's like really is the system at this point?
In terms of solving the justice system won't solve the problem. It will just solve the justice system.
Like if you say like inject drugs in public spaces or whatever, just an arbitrary rule, just to say, you know, and you do that 5 times, then you know you're sentenced.
But what if you could say the reason that person
is having to do that is because of what's happened?
The societal issues or whatever. Yeah, I mean, like that's always going to be part of the discussion, and that is actually that exact argument is become a major sticking point within the jurisprudence structure, right? Like when they're doing sentencing, Canadian judges have a high tendency to take into account, like, you know, person's social past or racial background or whatever it might be in terms of their sentencing. And again, that leads into the general narrative of sentencing that has to be taken into account in most cases. Otherwise, again, whatever judgment is passed is very subject to appeal.
And it's unfair.
Being considered unjust and unfair, right? So...
Because I always have to remember, like, because it's like just because like it's so easy to like ostracize the people that are like I always say homeless because it's an old term though, right? Like it's unhoused, right? And it's just like it really it's just they've had
they still say homeless.
Yeah, but they've like they just had a bad environment with bad luck and unfortunately like that's just how their life has gone. But that doesn't mean that their life is worth less. Right, and like that's the big part that I get hung up on. It's just like just because like I'm a contributing member to society and I want to pay taxes doesn't mean that they should get less healthcare.
I mean, I think that's
okay. But to speak on a personal note with this, where I recently met someone who was homeless and gave him some food and had a lovely conversation, during which he told me that he had been incarcerated for 2 or 3 years because of a violent offense. Prior to this, he had been a crane operator and had a very successful job with like multiple houses and several dogs and, you know, or sorry, at least one house and several vehicles. Then he lost his job because he committed this violent offense that may or may not have been related to a heroin thing. Because that happened, he got convicted. Because he got convicted, the bank seized all of his assets.
Yep.
And he left prison with nothing. He has no family. He has no friends. Yeah. And now he's on the street.
Yep.
So,
the ultimate punishment.
Well, in that type of situation, part of me is just like, what kind of criminal justice system sentences someone for 2 years and then allows a bank so that he's unable to fulfill any of his financial obligations, allows the banks to seize absolutely all of his assets and then leaves him with nothing? I mean, like, that doesn't seem like a...
reform?
Well, like... You're not giving him a chance once, like, he doesn't have, like, what kind of chance do you have if you're kicked out on the street after you leave prison with a criminal record in Canada?
That's always been like the sort of criticism of a lot of like punishment based justice, right? That ultimately it puts people in situations where they're more likely to reoffend in the long term, right? Because of, you know, basically their life gets, they make some sort of mistake. That mistake might be quite serious and might, you know, require some sort of societal response. But the response ends up basically robbing them of their entire, like, life structure, for lack of a better way of saying it.
Well, I mean, right? in his case, like, he lost his house. Lost his cars. He lost his job. He lost any attempt of ever having those things ever again. He had everything taken from him. I don't understand how society is better off now that he has to live on the street because he went to jail.
But the flip side of that is that, look, like,
we don't want to incentivize criminals who come out of jail.
No, and there are, well, like, there, so that's, that is been like a traditional, like, like kind of more progressive perspective, right? There are, however, like, as someone who works in the field, and that's like all I really say, there absolutely are people who are quite dangerous. Like, yeah, they, like, they are, like, they're, whether that be through, you know, through faults within society or trauma or whatever it is, the reality is they are quite dangerous. They're highly violent,
and by restricting their access to resources, we are
protecting society. But also by having them like taken out of society for like
they're
acts
unstable,
that they commit.
Right, when you're unstable, fight, flight, or freeze.
Well, some of them aren't even unstable. Some of them are just quite like to get too more about it, bad. But like, and but and then there's the up there is the other side of that, which is some of those individuals are also just like very mentally not well. And unfortunately, there's just like not a lot of like cures for that. But allowing those sorts of people to just like roam around then presents obvious, very obvious public health and safety risks.
Investing in prevention and public awareness would, I mean, if it was successful, it would reduce the amount of in rate, which would make the future problem, because if this problem compounds and we have more and more violent people on the street every month, every year, so on, like there comes a point where this will be entirely unmanageable. So you could argue that prevention, I mean, the problem with prevention is like it doesn't help the people who are actually suffering.
No,
but we do need both parts of a solution there.
But like if we're talking specifically about Vancouver and like this issue generally within Vancouver, you know, it's important to recognize that like the vast majority of individuals who we would view as like problematic or homeless or living in the streets of Vancouver,
well, I'm thinking more of like someone who's about to be unhoused and they need just like 1 month's rent support.
And they, so and they do have the lots job. Of services like that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not really the issue. I think it's more so just, like, in general, there is not enough support for these people. You know, like, really, think about it. It's hard enough for somebody who has two parents and has, a, you know, kind of somewhat of their head on straight and, you know, goes to school and goes to work and, you know, maybe ends up having a family or something. It is hard enough for the average person to live life nowadays, let alone somebody that had any kind of turmoil. Whether that's drugs, or if that's a trauma, or if it's an injury, or if it's a mental health issue, or if it's just shitty luck. You were born into the wrong time, the wrong place, and you're just surviving. That is kind of where I look at it.
But if you're talking about like, or everyone's talking about like preventative measures, the reality is like in these sorts of communities, or those populations that were like, you know, the healthcare discussion has kind of moved to, is that like most of those, the vast majority of people are not from a place like Vancouver. Right, they're from, you know, oftentimes out east or smaller towns or wherever it might be, where, you know, and a lot of times like the proportionality of Indigenous individuals is far, far higher, right, coming from small reserve towns and all that kind of stuff, where there is no opportunity, where, you know, these sort of like middle class systems and stuff like that have broken down, fractured, and you see just like when you have that sort of social and economic degradation, you're inevitably going to produce individuals who have like issues stemming from that, right?
So
and
economic prosperity for struggling communities is the solution to...
On some level,
on
sure.
prevention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying too, it's like you have to focus on the people who are already within those situations. Like that's all. There's also an ethical like duty there. But if we're thinking long term, and this like the way things are looking right now, it's not like a great look. Reality is like if communities are in a sense, and particular classes within those communities are in a decline, there's ample evidence to support the fact that things like substance abuse and mental health issues and criminality and all that kind of stuff increase exponentially, right? Like, we don't even need to think about Canada, but we can think about states like in the U.S., like West Virginia, which at one time was exceptionally prosperous with, like, the coal industry and stuff like that through the first half of the 20th century. Now, West Virginia is one of the poorest states in the United States and has the highest rate of drug use, largely because there is, and the population is also just, like, dropped off, right? Like, it's, like, a quarter or whatever of what it used to be in the 50s at its peak. And so you see these communities basically fall into degradation, and then also the individuals start to display all sorts of more like significant problems that then we start to look at, and this is kind of the interesting thing, you know, for studies, we then start to look at it as, oh, that's the problem. It's like, you know, there's so much drug use, or there's like, people with mental health issues, or there's whatever, there's poverty. But it's like, look, like these situations don't like, you know, you don't roll into like a super prosperous place like Singapore.
Well, Singapore has its own problems, right? It has a rapidly aging population, which and a declining birth rate, which we also have.
Probably a better example would be Switzerland, where basically everybody's rich, right? Like,
I mean, even Switzerland, I don't think that they have a rising birth rate, and I don't think that they have a rapidly aging population and a declining birth rate are problems. From a prosperity angle, like those two things basically mean that you're not going to have a prosperous country unless you create innovation and automation, because normally how economies grow is you have more people producing more things. Mm-hmm. If you don't have more people producing more things, then you have to have some kind of innovation or technological development in order to have any kind of increase in prosperity. If we are at the end of our increase on prosperity, then we can't look to that for fixing our future problems. Maybe prosperity isn't the solution to all of our problems. Maybe sometimes it's a matter of
philosophical.
Well, I mean obviously, like, you can't make bread out of thin air.
Yeah.
So some amount of prosperity is necessary, but at some point.
Yeah. But I mean, like, thinking about it, you know,
honestly though, innovation and technology, that's probably the only thing that can make up for the lost economic.
I want AI doctors now. I think that's the real solution.
Well, I mean it's scary to think about, but it's kind of like, what alternative is there?
And coming back around to like discussions about private public health care, it's like, look, there's one like is an obvious solution within, or I don't want to say it's a complete solution, but obvious, at least partial remedy within the scenario we're talking about at the beginning. In terms of like, well, if you introduce a lot of innovative technology that can take the place of, because of the finite resource of basically expertise, well, then you're kind of leveling out the playing field in terms of having like options for public versus private, right? Like basically in like this hypothetical, let's say where suddenly it's everything is like AI doctor done. And let's say that like bracket any other issues that might have. Right. If you could just introduce that sort of technological innovation on both a public and private side, in theory, it would be far easier to exponentially expand the public side to meet its fully Correct. Required needs, while also still having a private side that is sufficient to deal to support the individuals who are able to.
What I would love to see is more AI tools to help individuals care for their own health so that they don't get into as many desperate situations. If it's as simple as like, hey, take a picture of this thing at the grocery store and take a picture of this other thing. What is going to be the impact on my health based on my nutrition? Like you could make those kinds of choices.
But you need
choices.
To have that knowledge to know how to do it, right? Like, you know, like that's
still,
like health literacy nowadays is
still,
you know, non-existent.
Well, the other problem is nutrition is not like an exact obvious science. It varies a lot from person to person. It's not like you can say, like, you know, if this person eats this much tofu and this much potatoes, they'll be perfectly happy and they won't have anxiety and everything will be great. Like, that might be true for 1 out of 10 million, but it's not that simple when it comes to nutritional science either. Eventually we do get to a point where the type of individualized nutritional choices that doctors are unable to do because there's not enough hours in the day, AI is able to help a little bit with. But I mean, that's just a little bit of hope in a very complicated situation.
Because you also need people that can use the technology as well, right? Like, and that's part of the problem, right? Like, you're not going
to
have
your
95-year-old grandma.
Yeah, you can train people far more easily. Yeah. I have a knee-jerk reaction against arguing for AI, but I could see like why this makes sense, right? Especially within the context of finitude, right? Within like our, you know, professional
and where I am in the computer science world, it is like, it's really like all the computer science academics are like on the exact same page when it's just like,
you need like a drone.
Well, no. Like in terms of the ethics and privacy stuff, like, come on, we've been computer science professionals for like 30 years. How have we dropped the ball this far in terms of allowing companies to use legalese to walk all over us in terms of how we are forcing us to design things certain ways? I mean, like, you know, there are engineering guidelines in terms of designing bridges.
Yep.
We could have and like we could have
healthcare guidelines.
Well,
with AI.
Well, you know, there's
and that's what I think, because like with paramedicine, everything is a tree. It's just like
there are professional organizations. We could have professional organizations that oversee AI. People have recommended this. The problem with those organizations is that if they're corrupted, what are you going to do? You can't, if you get rid of that organization and you're left with the government handling it, then you're in an awful position.
I would argue that we are already corrupted, though.
So. Okay, I mean, yeah, but if you replace one kind of corruption with a worse kind of corruption,
it's
a really hard equation in terms of how do you make a new institution that is not prone to corruption, that will advocate in the best interest of society, and is linked to the technology sector, because the technology sector is not like other sectors. It's not like it's very dynamic. So it's a hard challenge.
It's one of the problems of systems in bureaucracy within the kind of society, especially within like modern states and social systems, is that they're very, very hard to dismantle. The solution to a lot of the, you know, what ultimately be health issues and judicial issues and criminal issues and stuff like that in society, often have direct relationships with prosperity, right? Both the individuals and societies being prosperous, and the idea that your children and the younger individuals and stuff can also participate in that system, right? That people have faith, they've bought in, all that kind of stuff. Your response, which is many people's other response, is like perhaps prosperity is not the way. Now you came and said, okay, well maybe we can have AI from there, but there's also the other side that's like, look, like maybe people have to accept that, like, look, like there was kind of a peak and we're on a decline, right? The problem with that though is that it's being far too charitable towards a individual's sense of just desserts within their social position.
I definitely don't have an answer for that challenge at this time. If you do have an answer for us, you can write in at hello@philosophyshow.ca. Thank you so much for listening, and looking forward to hearing from you next time. I've been Aaron Wang, joined by Hale Rotary, Kira Tianen, and Brandon Brownlee.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
With 1.5 million Canadians identifying as blind or having low vision, what will the future look like as we move to a world where using our eyes for screen time is at an all-time high? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind, where sports and recreation, technology training, and peer support are just a few of what they offer. To find out more, visit ccbbcyukon.com.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.